Good afternoon. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Tuesday, February 16th, 2021. This is our third of three oral arguments scheduled for today, and then we have two non-orals after this. This is case number 820-1192, Keith Johnson, D.C. versus Office of Administrative Hearings. Counsel for both parties will have 15 minutes for initial arguments, and then counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. This is being recorded, so no other recordings, either audio or video, are allowed. Thank you both for joining us virtually here versus being in person, which we would prefer, but we cannot do it at this time per the Chief Justice's order, so we are having virtual oral arguments. We will let you know if there are any technical difficulties that we run into during this hearing. We'll certainly make accommodations for that. We have done that in the past as well. You never know what will happen in our virtual world here. So with that, counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. My name is David C. Wolf. I'm representing the petitioner in this matter, Dr. Keith Johnson. This case involves a petition for declaratory judgment filed pursuant to Minnesota statutes 14.44 and 14.45, seeking review of the validity of Minnesota Rule 1420.1850. Minnesota statute 14.45 provides that this court shall declare a rule invalid if it finds that it, one, violates constitutional provisions, or two, exceeds the statutory authority of the agency, or three, was adopted without compliance with statutory rulemaking procedures. My client is asserting that Minnesota Rule 1420.1850 exceeds the statutory authority of the Office of Administrative Hearings and that its enforcement violates the constitutional rights of potential interveners who choose to exercise their right to not intervene in workers' compensation cases. My client is not arguing that OAH failed to comply with the technical statutory rulemaking procedures.
We all understand that Dr. Johnson is arguing under the rule provisions, but we all know that you need to prove that you have adequate standing for us to go ahead and address that rule that you recited. As far as Dr. Johnson is concerned, are you acknowledging, you are, I believe, in your opening remark, indicating that he chose not to file his claim for reimbursement?
He chose not to intervene in the workers' compensation claim being brought by the employee against his employer.
And of course, the Office of Administrative Hearings is arguing that the statute is specific and it says if you do not choose to file a motion to intervene, that's it, you're out. So why would the statute not be binding when we have a rule that seems to be more generous than a statute and says that the hearing officer may versus shall allow the claim to go forward?
The statute is 176.361 and it does not provide that the potential interveners who choose to exercise their right granted to them by the legislature under subdivision one to not intervene will have their rights extinguished. That's not what the statute says.
Well, the statute does say that if it's not timely filed, and in this case, it wouldn't have been timely filed, not because of inadvertence, but not timely filed because he chose not to file it, it says the potential intervener's interest shall be extinguished.
The only way to reach that interpretation of the statute is to read the last sentence on subdivision 2A in isolation and out of context. You have to read the entire statute and you have to read it in context with subdivision 1 and with the opening clause of subdivision 2. And you have to interpret the statute to ascertain the intent of the legislature and to give full force and effect to all of the provisions of the statute to the extent that that's possible. Subdivision 1 of 176.361 clearly indicates that intervention is a permissive right, not a mandatory obligation. It is the intent of the legislature that potential interveners shall have the option of choosing not to intervene. The very first sentence, or the very first clause of the very first sentence of subdivision 2 provides that any party who desires to intervene in the workers' compensation claim shall file a timely motion to intervene. But that implies and provides and clarifies that those potential interveners who desire, don't desire to intervene, can exercise their right under subdivision 1 to choose not to intervene. It also clarifies legislative intent is that the provisions of subdivision 2, including the last sentence of subdivision 2A, do not apply to potential interveners who exercise the right under subdivision 1 to choose not to intervene. That's the whole basis of the argument here.
But counsel, by choosing not to intervene, why is there necessarily no consequences for that?
There are consequences for
that. Well, the consequences are spelled out that if you don't file a timely intervention, your rights can be extinguished.
But the statute says that it only applies to those potential interveners who choose to file a motion to intervene. If they choose to file a motion to intervene, but they do so untimely, then the consequence is that their intervention interest shall be extinguished. That's what the statute says.
Isn't that saying the same thing, though? Because if you choose, how would one distinguish whether you chose not to file or whether you simply were not timely? I mean, there would be no distinction between the two.
Well, sure.
How do we know Mr. Johnson chose not to file versus the time period ran?
Well, that isn't the point. The point is that the statute
says... The statutes are to be read so that there's... we look at a statute not to be absurd, and if the statute says you have the option, and if you don't file in a timely fashion, you're out. So how could we read anything different?
Well, what's absurd about the interpretation that you're asserting and arguing, or what the state is asserting and arguing, is why would the legislature provide in subdivision 1 that potential interveners have the right to choose not to intervene? If they wanted to mandate intervention, the subdivision 1 would say potential interveners must or shall intervene. It's absurd.
I'm trying to answer your question, but there are other ways that individuals are compensated for their services besides intervening in a workers' compensation matter, aren't there?
Exactly. The primary right of a healthcare provider like my client, Dr. Johnson, to be compensated for the services that he rendered would be to sue the patient in district court for breach of contract for not paying. And that right was purportedly extinguished by an award on stipulation approving a settlement, which included a collusive agreement between Mr. Keenan and his employer, the two legal entities legally obligated to pay for Dr. Johnson's treatment, that his rights should be extinguished so that neither one of them should pay. That's the absurdity of the interpretation of the statute that the state is proposing.
Isn't it absurdity not intervening in the first place? Because the statute gives Mr. Johnson the right to intervene, and he didn't do that. And I want to note also your interpretation. You focus on subdivision 1 of Minnesota statute section 176.31, but also subdivision 2, the very opening clause where it says a person desiring to intervene, but it also says, if you finish that sentence, it says a person desiring to intervene, .. shall submit a timely written motion to intervene. which ties into subdivision A when it says, quote, where a motion to intervene is not timely filed under the section, comma, the potential intervener interest shall be extinguished. So I don't see how that's inconsistent with each other. It's saying you have the right to intervene. And if you intervene, you have to do it on a timely basis. If you don't do it on a timely basis, then your interest shall be extinguished. I don't see how that's an absurd interpretation of that. That seems very reasonable and logical.
But subdivision one also provides that potential interveners have a right to choose not to intervene.
Right. And if you choose not to intervene, then you run the risk of having your rights extinguished.
I disagree with that interpretation of the statute.
Okay. Well, let me stop you there because I don't think we're going to, it sounds like we're not going to convince each other one way or another. I want to move actually back to the question that Judge Warkey had, which I think is a very important question of standing. The compensation judge here evaluated this under the statute, and we've been talking about the statute for 10 minutes now. There is nothing said about the rule, and it seems to me, just speaking for myself, but the issue here that Dr. Johnson has is with the statute first and foremost. And if that's the case, then it seems to me that Dr. Johnson doesn't have really any standing to challenge the rule at this stage. This is the wrong vehicle to challenge the statute. And if that's the case, then we have to dismiss outright then, don't we?
I don't think so, for two reasons. One, and primarily, Minnesota Statute 14.45 clearly provides that this court shall declare a rule invalid.
I understand that we're very familiar with that rule. My question to you is how does he have standing to challenge the rule when it's really the statute that is at issue here? The statute says that right shall be extinguished. The rule says may be extinguished. It's the rule it's the statute that's at issue here, isn't it?
Well, but you have to look at the statute in order to determine whether the rule is invalid because it exceeds the statutory authority. There isn't any other way to address that grounds for invalidating the rule without looking at the statute.
Let me ask you this. I realize I'm putting you on the spot, but have you had a chance to read? We have issued two opinions recently on the whole standing issue. One is a published opinion that came out a couple of weeks ago, and a week later we had another opinion on this issue on claims brought. And both of those cases, we held that because petitioners did not have standing, we did not even get to the merits of the case.
What are the names of the cases?
I'm sorry?
What are the names of those cases?
Sure. It's the Minnesota Voters Alliance cases.
Okay, I have not read those.
Okay. But even if you look back at other case law prior to that published case law, Minnesota Supreme Court and Minnesota Court of Appeals has made it very clear that if there's no standing, we don't even get to the issue on its merits. And I'm struggling to understand why you have standing to attack a rule when the statute is what seems to what was discussed below and seems to be what is being challenged here in this appeal.
Well, 14.44 says that the validity of any rule may be determined by this court when it appears that the rule or its threatened application interferes with or impairs or threatens to interfere with or impair the legal rights or privileges of the petitioner. That's exactly what happened in this case. The award on stipulation issued by compensation Judge Tate in reliance of Minnesota Rule 1420.1850 extinguished his legal rights, not only within the workers' comp system, but in district court, and eliminated any right that he may have to seek payment of the treatment that he provided. In a case where it was never even established that a work-related injury occurred.
If the rule simply follows the statute under our Rocco Altobelli ruling that's cited in a respondent's brief, if it merely follows it, then the person has no standing. So
but it's the application of the rule, Judge, in this case and under these circumstances that we're challenging.
But the application would be the same, virtually the same under the rule or the statute. In fact, it's harsher under the statute than it is the rule.
Still results in my client being screwed out of his money.
That and that's my point, is the rule follows the statute. And if the rule follows the statute, then the issue is not with the rule, it's with the statute, and the person has no standing.
What compensation Judge Tate did in issuing the award and stipulation and including a provision extinguishing my client's legal rights to be paid under both the workers' comp system and in district court did not follow either the statute or the rule. There has to be some basis to challenge that.
Your client is not without a remedy. You're saying there's no basis to challenge it. What about suing the individual that benefited from the chiropractic services? That's an option, is it not?
The award on stipulation purports to extinguish his right to do that. And that's, you know, and that's why it's unconstitutional for several different reasons, but my time is up.
Did you have another question, Judge Warke?
I did, but I'm going to wait until the rebuttal time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wolf. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and we'll turn out to Mr. Barr.
May it please the court. My name is Alan Barr. I represent the Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings with respect to this challenge to one of its procedural rules. The court should dismiss this case for lack of jurisdiction because a decision from this court invalidating Minnesota Rule 1420.1850, subpart 1A, would not redress the alleged injury that Dr. Johnson is alleging. Accordingly, he lacks standing to bring this rule challenge. Petitioner challenges one specific sentence in Rule 1420.1850 that if a workers' compensation judge determines that a potential intervener had notice of the right to intervene within a reasonable time but fails to intervene, the judge may order extinguishment of the potential intervener's interest under MnSTAT 176.361. That rule doesn't add anything that isn't already present in the statute, as you've been discussing at length for the last 15 minutes. The statute itself says that where a motion to intervene is not timely filed, the potential intervener interest shall be extinguished. So application of the rule does not result in any more injury than the application of the statute. As a result, there's no injury that can be traced to the statute under both the more recent Minnesota Voters Alliance case that Judge Reyes brought up, along with the historical Rocoa line of cases. There's no standing to bring this rule challenge. Dr. Johnson makes three arguments in his brief and is focused first, is primarily an oral argument on the may language of the statute, saying that because there is the word that you may intervene in workers' compensation cases, that implies there's a right not to intervene. The Office of Administrative Hearings agrees that you don't have to intervene in a workers' compensation case if you don't want to, but that doesn't mean there are not consequences for failing to do so. The statute lays out those consequences and says that if you do not file a timely petition to intervene, then your rights are extinguished. In other cases, the Minnesota Supreme Court has also held that just because you have a permissive right to do something does not mean there are not consequences if you choose not to. Here, the choice for not intervening in a workers' compensation case is that you don't get to collect. There's also some discussion that why have a choice not to intervene unless there was some option, but there are at least two reasons I can think of off the top of my head why someone might choose not to intervene. And that's if a case is settled through some other means prior to the workers' compensation case being initiated, or if it's not just worth the cost. If you have a bill that isn't worth the litigation expenses, a party could, again, choose not to intervene. So it is not absurd to say that your interest will be extinguished if you don't intervene, even though there is this may language at the beginning of the statute. In petitioner's brief, petitioner
also— Mr. Barr, just to be clear, you're, when you talked about the may language, you're talking about the rule versus the statute, correct?
I was referring to the statute, Your Honor.
Are you talking about file, or are you, just to be clear, you're talking about filing the intervention? Okay.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
I'm talking about that there's the may language that petitioner was discussing in the statute, that you may file a petition to intervene.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Was discussing. There's also two other arguments that petitioner makes in his brief with respect to why they claim that this sentence only applies if someone chooses to intervene. First, they argue that there are Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals cases holding that that you have to have some form of intervention in order to have rights extinguished, but that's not what those cases say. If you look at the most recent WCCA case dealing with this issue, which is actually Cohen v. Marie, excuse me, one moment, I had my brief up and now. Cohen v. Fledged Marine Co. In that case, the WCCA explicitly rejected the argument that these other WCCA cases suggest that that intervention is necessary in order to have rights extinguished. Instead, they explicitly reject the argument that Dr. Johnson's now making here. Additionally, his third argument appears to be that the WCCA has no jurisdiction with respect to extinguishing these claims until it's established that there is it's a compensable injury under workers' compensation law. But that's not the case. Jurisdiction goes to whether or not the court can hear the case at all, not the merits of it. Under Dr. Johnson's reading of jurisdiction, unless a case definitively settles with a determination that it's a compensable injury, the Workers' Compensation Court would never have jurisdiction to issue opinions. So that interpretation is frankly entirely unreasonable. Turning to the constitutional issues, Dr. Johnson argues that the statute violates due process, that it violates separation of powers, or excuse me, not the statute, that the rule violates due process, violates separation of powers, and violates the void for vagueness doctrine. With respect to due process, both the rule and the statute on which the rule is based provide for notice and an opportunity to be heard. Dr. Johnson received notice that he had to intervene or his rights would be terminated. He then chose not to. The fact that someone chooses not to take advantage of the process that is given to them does not mean that they lack due process. Similarly, with respect to the separation of powers issues, the Minnesota Supreme Court is over half a century ago held that merely because these sorts of claims have to be raised within the workers' compensation venue does not result in any separation of powers issues. There's a process to be followed, which ultimately results in judicial review. And the court's held that merely directing things to a particular venue, the workers' compensation court, rather than district court, doesn't violate separation of powers principles. Finally, with respect to Dr. Johnson's void for vagueness arguments, those arguments all go to the statute. Dr. Johnson doesn't point to any vagueness that's in the rule, only vagueness that he claims results from his incorrect reading of the statute. So even if the court reaches those issues, there's no basis for a void for vagueness challenge. Unless the court has additional questions, I yield the remainder of my time.
Looks like we don't have any other questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Barr. Mr. Wolf, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Judge Werke, did you have an additional question?
Trying to find my mute button. The question I had for you, Mr. Wolf, has to do with the entitlement to receiving compensation. The argument, of course, when the workers' compensation matter began was whether in fact the injuries were caused by something attributable to the workplace. And you did not respond to that in any fashion, did you?
Let me see if I understand what you're saying.
I mean, you didn't engage in any dealings with either the employer or the medical care provider at that time. You were simply dealing, my question is, were you simply dealing with Mr. Johnson, Dr. Johnson?
I'm the attorney for Dr. Johnson, if that's what you're asking. But what happened is Mr. Keenan came to Dr. Johnson for treatment of a back condition.
That's who I meant. Dr. Johnson sought compensation from Keenan, but he didn't go after, at that point, the employer.
Well, no, he can't. He doesn't have standing to sue the employer. So the injured employee, Mr. Keenan, sought treatment from my client, Dr. Johnson, for a back condition. He got excellent treatement.
Well, let me ask you that. Why doesn't he have standing to sue the employer?
Because Mr. Keenan, in order to avoid having to pay for the treatment himself, argued or alleged that he had suffered a work-related injury. As soon as a patient alleges that he suffered a work-related injury, the workers' comp statute prohibits the healthcare provider from collecting or attempting to collect for the charges from the injured employee until the workers' comp system can work its magic.
That's my point. But with that knowledge in mind, wouldn't someone such as your client, Dr. Johnson, move to intervene? Is that not a tactical decision?
No, it doesn't make any difference to him how the workers' comp claim is resolved, because either Mr. Keenan prevails and establishes that he suffered a work-related injury, in which case Dr. Johnson's treatment is payable by the employer and its insurer, or Mr. Keenan fails and the employer prevails in its argument that no work-related injury occurred, in which case Mr. Keenan is responsible for payment of Dr. Johnson's treatment. Either way, Dr. Johnson should have gotten paid. So he has no incentive to waste
Dr.
his time.
Dr. Johnson wouldn't have received payment under the workers' compensation statute if this was not work-related.
Thus,
the reason you want to intervene.
No, if Mr. Keenan, but that's a dispute between Mr. Keenan and his employer. And the Supreme Court has held in case after case after case that the burden of proving the existence of a work-related injury is on the employee, not on the providers. That's the Brooks automatic payment rule case, if you want to take a look at that. But Dr. Johnson had no reason to intervene in the workers' compensation case because it wasn't his burden to prove that a work-related injury occurred. That burden was Mr. Keenan's.
Why isn't it reasonable, though, reading the statute and realizing that failure to intervene shall result in extinguishment of rights? Why wouldn't somebody intervene just to preserve those rights?
That isn't what the statute says, Judge. The statute says that potential
Mr. Wolf, I understand that you have one interpretation of it. But let's assume for the sake of argument that another reasonable interpretation is that it will extinguish the rights based on the language. Why wouldn't it be reasonable to intervene just to protect the rights regardless of what happens in that underlying dispute?
Well, in addition to my interpretation of the statute, which I continue to contend is correct, and I understand that we'll have to agree to disagree on that. But in the three cases that I cited in my brief, the Adams case, the Irvin case, and the Millennius case, the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals clearly stated that healthcare providers are not obligated to to file motions to intervene. The employee has the right and the obligation to make a direct claim for payment of their unpaid bills if they want to avoid having to pay it themselves.
I'm going to try to better state what my question is, because I brought up the question, well, to you, doesn't Mr. Johnson have other remedies? And in this case, Dr. Johnson's remedy could have been pay as you receive service, have a co-signer, mother, somebody else, or have a prepayment plan. Would that not have been other avenues of payment or redress for Mr. Johnson, Dr. Johnson?
That would have arguably violated several provisions of the Minnesota Workers' Compensation Act. But I would love it if this court would include in its decision in this case that my client continues to have the legal right to sue Mr. Keenan for payment of his unpaid charges.
No, my question wasn't suing Mr. Keenan, because we have an order that included Mr. Keenan. I'm asking you, weren't there other available avenues for Mr. Johnson, Dr. Johnson, to be assured that he would be paid short of intervening?
No, Mr. Keenan had no health insurance, and the workers' compensation statute includes provisions that prohibit healthcare providers from collecting or attempting to collect their charges from injured employees until the workers' compensation claim is resolved through adjudication. So he didn't have any options.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wolf. Any other questions from Judge Kalatowski or Judge Warkey?
I'm good.
Okay. Thank you both for your oral arguments and your briefing on this. We will issue an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe.